and Michael for looking after you so well and inviting me here. So great pleasure to be here. Approaching scripture as an academic. Let me start with a quote from a physicist called Enrico Fermi, who said, "Never underestimate the pleasure an audience receives in hearing something it already knows." Start by telling you something about what you already know. And that's the importance of the Bible. But then I want to move on to talk briefly about why the Bible is under threat at the moment. And then, what are the principles we should have for interpreting scripture as an academic? And then to give some examples, I'm going to give some examples from early Genesis, then look at the Exodus, and then look at miracles, and finally say something about biblical inspiration. And when I was preparing this, Michael Clifford and Maythree very kindly said, what you should do is to say something which is missing from usual sermons. So I'll try and say something which is missing from usual sermons. So let's just start by reminding ourselves of the importance of the Bible. I've got a very battered Bible in my case here. But we all think, I'm sure, this is the greatest book that's ever been written. So it's both quantitatively and qualitatively, I find, different from any other book. It's the basis, of course, for our Christian faith. Without it, we would know nothing about Jesus, almost nothing. There's a bit about Jesus in a few sentences in Tacitus, the Roman historian, a little bit in the Jewish historian Josephus, and thank God for those bits which are outside the Bible, because they enable us to say that, you know, Jesus really existed. But, you know, we'd really know nothing about Jesus if it wasn't for the Bible. And we know nothing about the wisdom in the book of Proverbs that Addison talked to us about yesterday, nothing about the wisdom in the words of Jesus, or in Peter, or in Paul. We wouldn't be able to wonder at the resurrection, really. We wouldn't know much about the resurrection without the Bible. So the Bible's really, really important. But I think the Bible is under threat, certainly more than any time in the last 250 years, possibly more than any time ever. By this movement, which calls itself the New Atheists, or New Atheism. Key players, of course, are Richard Dawkins. You'll know his book, The God Delusion, published in 2006. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for 51 weeks. I mean, it's astonishing. You know, very few books make it to the New York Times bestseller list. To be on for 51 weeks is astonishing. It's had huge sales and huge influence. And then other people who are part of this New Atheism movement, Richard Dawkins, of course, a scientist, a biologist, Daniel Dennett, an American philosopher, he wrote a book in 2006 as well, Breaking the Spell, Religion as a Natural Phenomenon. And then also part of this group, very influential, Christopher Hitchens, who died fairly recently, very eminent writer and journalist. He wrote a book in 2007, God is Not Great, How Religion Poisons Everything. And, you know, these books came out, two in 2006, one in 2007. I suspect they were coordinated. I think this group has been working a little behind the scenes, got its act together, now operates as a group, a number of other people, part of that group. And they're just powerful speakers, sold many books, a huge influence. And I think what is different from before is these people are working as a team. So Richard Dawkins speaks to Daniel Dennett. He understands philosophy quite well. Daniel Dennett understands science quite well. They work with journalists, they're speaking as a team, and they're very effective. And we know that, you know, they misrepresent Christianity. We know that Richard Dawkins sets up this sort of straw man of an extreme Christian and knocks him down, and knocks him or her down. So they misrepresent Christianity, but nevertheless, they're extremely effective. They've got their act together. And the Christian response so far has been weak, I think. You know, listen to debates on television and radio between Dawkins and some eminent Christians. And if you're honest, the Christians are losing this debate because we haven't really got our act together. So this is a challenge to you and the audience that you know, we're really looking for people who will respond to this. If Paul was around today, he would respond to this in a wonderful way. And we just don't have this. So we need people like this. And it takes a lot of wisdom to respond, because these are eminent people. Their arguments are now very well developed. I was in a debate with Richard Dawkins a long time ago on BBC World Service, and he was easily defeated in debate then. but not so easily now. And their ideas are really very well developed. So that's a challenge to people here. The new atheism, I think, is winning the day at the moment, and we've got to get our act together and respond to this. Well, let's move on to how should we approach Scripture as an academic? And let me just talk about a few basic principles. The first one, I think, is, as we know, we should not separate our academic life from our Christian life. When we read a newspaper, at least when I read a newspaper, I look for the news with sort of one eye, but I'm sort of reading it as a scientist with the other eye. Right? I don't separate, when I read a newspaper, my scientific training from my reading the newspaper. And I'm sure we should be just doing the same with the Bible. When you read the Bible, I should read the Bible with one eye to say, you know, what is God been doing? What's he trying to say here? What's he trying to say to me here? But also with the eye of science. You read it as a scientist. Or you may be a linguist. You read the Bible through the eye of a believer and the eye of a linguist. Or you may be a historian or a geographer. And you read it with your own discipline as well. You don't divorce your own discipline when you read the Bible and read the scriptures. And, you know, linguists have got a lot to tell us about the Bible, as have geographers and historians and so on, or if a philosopher. So that's, I think, the first thing we should do when we try and approach Scripture as an academic. A few more general principles. This one well known. The first question to ask when you read the Scriptures is, what did the writer mean? And what did his original audience understood him to mean? Would they have taken it literally? Did he mean the text to be taken literally or figuratively? What was the context? And only really then, if we can understand what the writer meant to say to his original audience, can we then really say what the text should mean to us today. But we should first of all say, what did the original author mean? Then, another point, how does God work in our world? Now, we all believe, I'm sure most of us believe, all believe, that God can do anything. But I think that when you read the Bible, and we'll come to this in a moment, the key question to ask is not what could God do, because we should believe God could do anything, but what did God do, and what does God do today? Then, fourth point, I think probably at least 90% of the Bible, it's clear if the text is meant to be taken literally or not. Right? It's pretty plain. Maybe the other 10%, it is not so clear. And I think the approach we should have in every case is to try to take the Bible literally first. And if that doesn't work out, you may be justified in saying this is meant to be symbolic. For example, the Star of Bethlehem, just in one gospel, was that meant to be a literal star? Was it some sort of symbolic light in the sky? And to start with, you should think it's a literal star. And I actually think it was a literal star. But, you know, you should take these things, you should err on the side of literalism, I think, before moving on. And then, last point, what if science and the Bible disagree? And the key point to remember here is that the God who has revealed himself to us through the Bible is the same God who has revealed himself to us through his creation, which is what scientists study. It's often said, put a slightly different way, the God who's revealed himself to us through his word is the same God who has revealed himself to us through his works. Hence, both revelations must agree. And if they don't agree, it means that either our interpretation of the Bible is wrong or our interpretation of science is wrong. So I think that's an important general principle. Right, let us move back to some examples. And I take the example with a bit of trepidation. The first few chapters of Genesis, the Genesis creation account, I'm sure we will have some creationists and evolutionists in the audience, but I thought saying something about science in the Bible is hard to avoid this. My parents actually were creationists. I was brought up as a creationist. I went to Imperial College as an undergraduate and found that no academic there believed that the world was created in 7 days in 4000 BC or thereabouts. And so perhaps for the first time I started approaching Scripture as an academic. And the first thing I say about this, I want to do it with it fairly briefly, because the fact is, a rather remarkable fact, if you look at the Old Testament never refers to the creation story again. Quite remarkable. It refers to Abraham, refers to Moses a lot, never refers to the creation story again. If you look at the words of Jesus, he never talks about Adam or the creation story. He talks about Abraham, talks about Moses a lot. So it wasn't high on their radar, all right? And so if we're being scriptural, we shouldn't spend huge amounts of time talking about this. And it's just, I think, quite a remarkable fact. Let me tell you why I think the writer of Genesis himself is a pick up a book that I wrote about this. Why the writer gives clues. He didn't want it. He didn't mean it to be taken literally. These are clues I think the writer gives, or some of them. To start with, the book mentions the Tree of Life. Now, the Tree of Life is mentioned again in the Book of Revelation, and when it's in the Book of Revelation, I think very few people would take it as a literal tree. So why should we take it as a literal tree when it occurs in the Book of Genesis? Some of the story, I would say, is meant to be taken as symbolic. So, a serpent that talks. So, a serpent doesn't have a voice box, so it cannot talk. Okay, God can do anything, so I agree, God could talk. Well, the devil could talk to a serpent. The serpent could be made to talk. But, you know, it's just a hint to my mind. It's meant to be taken, or it could be a hint. It's a symbolic serpent. Then we have the sun and moon appearing on day four. Yet, you know, the evening and the morning were the first day, the evening and the morning were the second day. You cannot have an evening and a morning without the sun. And the writer of Genesis was not stupid. He would know this. So by putting in the creation of the sun on the fourth day, but the evening and the morning on days 1, 2, and 3, it's again a hint to me. This is probably meant to be a symbolic story. Then just coming back to that, this is a very strange phrase. The evening and the morning was the first day, because the Jewish day ran from evening to evening, so you expect the writer to say the evening to evening was the first day. Or it's quite likely that before the exile in Babylon, the Jews had a morning to morning day, so then the writer would say the morning to morning was the first day. But he says the evening to the morning was the first day. And Donald Wiseman made a suggestion about this, and I'm not sure if it's right, but I think it's quite plausible that these 7 days of creation were 7 days in which creation was revealed through a series of dreams. So on one day, the writer had a dream, and this was the dream he revealed. This was creation revealed to him on the first day. And that was the evening and the morning, the time when you're asleep. So evening and morning makes sense, from the evening to the morning. And then on the second day of Revelation, third day of Revelation. And that's what Donald Wiseman suggested, who's an Assyriologist. And I think it may not be right, but I think it's quite plausible. And then, to my mind, one of the key things which suggests to me that the writer intended this to be an allegorical or symbolic story is just the choice of the word Adam. Because Adam is not normally, it isn't normally translated as the name of a particular man. Adam is just a word which in Hebrew means man, or representing man or mankind. And if you look at the Old Testament, Adam is used over 500 times, and it's nearly always translated man or mankind. And what happened in the Authorized Version of the Bible, in these first few chapters of Genesis, Adam is given there with capital A, but by the time the Revised Version was written, Adam there is just replaced by man with a small m. So Adam means representative man. And to my mind, it's almost as if the author, has deliberately chosen his name to mean representative man, rather than choosing a real name of a person. So I think there are clues in the story which suggest it's not meant to be taken literally. And this has been known for a long time. Let me quote to you from a church father called Origen. He wrote this in the 3rd century AD. He was an evangelical fundamental Christian, all right? I mean, he wrote books refuting error. And this is what he says. It's quite strong language. This is about the early chapter of Genesis. He says, "Who that has understanding will regard the statement as truthful that the first 3 days existed without sun, moon, and stars, and the first day without even a sky? And who is so ignorant as to suppose that God planted a real tree in Eden such that anyone eating of it with bodily teeth should obtain life, and eating with another tree should come to the knowledge of good and evil. No one, I think, can doubt that these things related figuratively, not literally, in Scripture, and some mystical meaning may be indicated by it. So very strong words. Conservative, evangelical Christian in the 3rd century AD, and a lot of early Christians and Jews were of the view that Genesis, these early chapters, were not meant by the writer to be taken literally. And then, of course, if we then bring in science, then science is very clear, if you look at radioactive dating methods, that the world, the Earth, really is very old and formed, you know, about 4,600 million years ago. So that's just a first example of where I think you can look at what the author intended, bring in science as well, and I think reach a conclusion that the first few chapters are not meant to be taken literally. Now, I know some people will not agree with that, and I want to move on from that. Let's move on to Moses and the Exodus from Egypt, because this is probably the major theme of the Old Testament in many ways. Many today believe that the Exodus was not a historical event, and one of the first people to say this with some force was an Anglican bishop called Bishop Colenso. He was the first Anglican bishop of Natal, and he concentrated on the numbers involved in the Exodus. The book of Exodus says over 600,000 fighting men were involved. He just said this is impossibly high. And you know, if you go back in time, the populations of lands shrunk, if you go back in time, if you like, have expanded as you go forward in time. And these are just huge numbers when you're considering populations at the time of the Exodus, which was probably in about 1270 BC. So, what is a problem with these large numbers in Exodus? And why should we not take this story as a myth, if we think the first few chapters of Genesis are not meant to be taken as historical? And I think there's a good reason for taking Exodus as historical, because you've got real characters there, a lot of geographies in the book of Exodus, a lot of history in the book of Exodus. And let me just read to you what the problem with the numbers is, and what the book of Exodus says. So this is, for example, from the book of Numbers. And so he, that's Moses, counted them in the desert of Sinai. All the men, 20 years old or more, were able to serve in the army, were listed by name. The total number was 603,550. So it sounds like a very factual statement. Moses counted them, they were counted by name. And you've got this huge number of people, 603,550. So why is that a problem? Well, it's a problem not only because it's a really large number, which you wouldn't expect. It's a problem because the number seems to be inconsistent with other numbers in the same story. So, you know, when you're looking for internal consistency in the Bible, it doesn't seem to be...
Throw off the reference.
That reference was Numbers chapter 1, verse 19, 20, 21, 46. I've just compressed it a bit. So if there were 603,000 men over 20, then in earlier populations, roughly half the population is above 20, half the population under 20. So you're talking about 1 million men, and if they're roughly number equal to women, you're talking about 2 million people in the Exodus from Egypt, which is this huge number. So I became interested in this, but the question is, is there another interpretation which does justice to the text, or do we have to go with this 600,000 number? So let's have a look at the number to start with. What's the problem with it? It's a very large number. At the famous Battle of Waterloo in 1815, there were 69,000 people as a comparison. The Greek historian Herodotus tells us about the number of people in the Egypt army at the time. Now, of course, he may not have got his facts right, so I won't quote his number, but it was many, many fewer than this. So the Israelites, if there were 600,000, almost certainly many, many times the Egyptian army. If that was the case, why should the Israelites have been terrified, which is what the Bible says, of the Egyptian army which was pursuing them? If there were so many. Okay, the Egyptians may have been better armed. 600,000 people, they just overwhelmed them. So why should they be terrified? Later on in the Exodus story, Exodus 17:8, we record, or the Bible records, the Israelites fighting some nomadic tribesmen called the Amalekites. And it's a long battle. You know, for 600,000 Israelites, why should it be a long battle? And then there's a nice clue, I think, of the midwives. Exodus 1:15 says, the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah. Two midwives for 2 million people, not enough, right? And then this huge number of people, this is what Moses says when he's talking to them at Mount Sinai. The Lord did not set his affection on you and choose you, because you were more numerous than other peoples, for you were the fewest of all people. It doesn't square with the 600,000. Then Exodus later says the Israelites were too few to occupy the promised land initially. But 2 million Israelites would easily have filled Israel. Until quite recently, the population of Israel was about 1 million. But this is the crunch for me. So, later on in Numbers, Numbers says the total number of firstborn males a month or more old was 22,273. So 22,000 firstborn males. But if the number of men aged over 20 was 600,000, that means you've got about 1 million men, 22,000 of whom were firstborn. So the average mother must have had 50 men as children, and 50 women as well on average. So the average mother must have had 100 children. So if you take the numbers, fight as they stand, the whole thing is inconsistent. So, do we dismiss it, as many scholars do, or do we say, is there another interpretation? And so I got involved in this because I just got interested in it. And a lot of people have looked at this. The first thing to realise is that in all languages, in English for example, the same word can have different meanings. Let me take an example, crab, alright? Crab can be something which swims around in the sea. There's a zodiacal constellation called the Crab Constellation. There's a nebula called the Crab Nebula. There's an apple, a crab apple. If you're a rowing person, you know if when you row, you can be said to catch a crab. So crab in English can have at least six different meanings. And normally, we get the meaning right because of the context. So when you use the word crab, you know, if you're eating something, you're eating a crab, you know, or a crab apple, you normally get the meaning right. But there's the possibility for confusion, that's clear. Now what is interesting is, the word in Hebrew, translated thousand, is the word eleph. And that has another meaning, and that other meaning is group, or troop, or family. And the Old Testament translates this in these different ways, in different places. So, in Genesis 20, there's a statement, I'm giving your brother 1,000 shekels of silver. Eleph is 1,000. Eleph is almost certainly correctly translated there, because that's what makes sense. But later on, let's look at the Judges. The book of Judges 6:15. My clan, Eleph, is the weakest in Manasseh. It clearly doesn't mean thousand, it means clan, so it's translated clan. Professor Adam Millard tells me that in Assyrian, again, the same word can mean thousand or clan. So it's a double meaning in both ancient Hebrew and ancient Assyrian. And then if you look at how different English translations have translated this differently, the King James Version and the Revised Standard Version translates 1 Samuel 23:23, all the thousands that are left of Judah, whereas the NIV says all the clans of Judah. So the NIV translation says, okay, these earlier English translators are wrong. That should be clan, not thousand. And there's a few other cases I won't go into, but in this book, I'm sorry, where Eleph can have these two meanings, but actually British biblical translators of themselves got the wrong meaning, and then it's been corrected in later translations. So then the key question is, has there been a mistranslation here? So I was reading myself the Book of Numbers, and you know, sometimes things leap off the page to you, as it were, and there are the same in Numbers, which is the following statement. The 273 firstborn Israelites exceed the number of Levites. That's Numbers 3:46. And what struck me as interesting about this statement is the number 273, because it's small. You go through the book for these numbers, these large numbers, and then this number 273 appears. And so I thought, well, you know, it's very small, it's likely to be right, it's not a symbolic number. Sometimes in the Bible you get numbers 3 and 7 and 40, and to my mind, sometimes they'd be taken literally, and sometimes they are symbolic numbers. And if the Israelites are in wandering for 40 years, you know, probably not precisely 40 years, or Jesus 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness, probably not 40, you know, about a month, say. But because they are used as symbolic numbers. And in other literature. But 273 is clearly seems to be a real number. And then being a scientist, I thought, you can write down a mathematical equation. You can say the number of firstborn Israelites minus the number of Levites is 273. Equation. And then you can write down some other equations. So I did this. And then you can solve these equations and say what the number of Israelites were. So I did this and worked it through. And the total number of Israelites... The total number of men aged over 20 shrinks from 650,000 to 5,550. So a huge difference. So that means the total population, men and women and everybody, about 20,000. I published this in something called Vetus Testamentum. It's unusual for scientists to publish. The leading Old Testament journal, the first time equations had ever been used in this journal. but there's something which puzzled me about this, because you not only get the total number of people out of this, you get the size of a tribe. What is LF, the size of a tribe? In this case, a troop, size of a troop, because we're talking about military men. And the size of a troop came out to be 10. And I thought, far too small. You know, you think of a troop of soldiers today, you think, I don't know, several hundred. And so I started hunting around to see what the size of a troop was in the time of the Exodus. And there's something called the Telamana tablets, which are discovered in Egypt. Now they're called the Amarna tablets, discovered Telamana. And there's one of these, one of these tablets, which is a request from King Rib Adai, a lovely name, of Byblos in modern Lebanon, right to the King of Egypt. And he says, please send me a troop of 10 men from Nubia. Right, so, you know, so the troop size then was about 10 men, and we have documentary evidence of it. So so it would seem that the whole story hangs together, and that the number of people in Exodus was probably, the number of fighting men over 20 years old was probably about 5,000. I think this then... So why is it important? Why is it not like an exercise? Because I think it removes a major obstacle to people saying the Exodus must be a symbolic story, not a factual story. Because we're saying, okay, this 500,000 is a mistranslation, and in fact a mistranslation by scribes copying the early texts. So that's I think it's important. It shows that the story is plausible. Let's look at my watch. I'd just like to say a few words as well about the date of the Pentateuch. That's the first five books in the Old Testament. And there's been this sort of battle over time where the more evangelical Christians have been saying, "Well, no, these books of the Old Testament are very early. You know, must be very early books." And liberal scholars have been saying, no, they're, you know, written in the exile in Babylon and in about 6th century BC or maybe even later. And it's very hard to date books. This is the first thing. It's very hard to date. All you can really do is to look at the language used and compare it with language in external literature. But Alan Millard, who I know well, who's some of you will know Alan Millard, is a very, very fine evangelical Christian, a great scholar, and he reckons that the language used in the Book of Exodus, the Book of Numbers, is the language used about the 8th century BC, right? And the Exodus itself in about 1270 BC. And other scholars will put it later. And what I say is, it doesn't matter, because you have to realise what happened when these books were written. So I'm very happy to believe that a lot of the first five books of the Bible were written by Moses. But then they were, those texts were handed down, and maybe other authors had put together, and then scribes would copy them. But when scribes copied them, they copied accurately, but they updated. This is well known. We've got records over from Egypt and Babylon. The scribes would update them. So if the name of a place had changed, the scribes would often put in the modern name. If the scribes thought they could, you know, just clarify something, they'd put it in. They'd update the language, of course. I mean, it's like when we have modern translation of the Bible, we use modern language, and they would do the same. And so, from the time when I think Moses, if he was the author of this part, if he would have used LF correctly to use mean truth, he put in LF, everyone who read it there in the original audience, they would know there weren't 600,000 fighting men. You know, they'd know what the numbers are like. The writer would understand it, the readers originally would understand it, time went on, and then some scribe just conflated numbers, decided LF should be 1,000 and so on. And so this is how these mistranslations can occur, and scribal errors can occur. And I'll just mention in passing about the date of the Gospels, because I think a lot of evangelicals try to force the Gospels into being very early documents, whereas a lot of people, scholars, more liberal scholars, will say, no, you know, probably Mark about 60 AD, maybe John about 90 AD. My view is it doesn't matter, because if you look at Luke's Gospel, for example, Luke says, I've carefully consulted eyewitnesses before, you know, so I think it's Luke 1:3, I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, consulted eyewitnesses on this. And so what we have are eyewitness type accounts, which I think the written documents may be very early, and it may be the final text we have, date from 60, 60 or later. But you have to realise, I think, that these are early eyewitness documents and eyewitness type documents, and the date of the final text we have actually doesn't matter, I don't think. So I think it's a non-debate. I'll slip that in. And I'll also say, I mean, I think it's actually quite complicated. So, you know, the conventional wisdom is that John's Gospel was the last one written. I mean, there is, I think, an increasing opinion that parts of John were actually first written. Right, so it's just more complicated. So you have different sources for different Gospels. So Peter, you know, was a source for Mark's Gospel largely. But you have different sources, and some of the sources are earlier than other sources. And just to say, Mark's the last Gospel written, John the last Gospel written, and Mark the first Gospel, is probably a bit simplistic. But I think they are based on very early eyewitness reports. And then the final text may be quite a bit later. So I'd now like to move on to, having said that I think Exodus is a historical event, let me move on to looking at miracles in Exodus. And I'm going to talk about this because one of the questions I'm mainly asked about, I suppose as a scientist, people say to me, do you really believe in miracles? Scientists really believe in miracles. So I thought I'd say something about miracles and look in some detail, if we've just about got time to do this, at an Exodus miracle, really in some detail. So, what is a miracle? This is a definition from Wikipedia, because this is a definition that people believe in, whether it's right or so. I actually don't like this definition, but this is a definition. A miracle can be defined as a violation of natural law by a supernatural being. So I think a bit too simple, but anyway, that's what people really know about. This is what Richard Dawkins, I have to quote Dawkins again, says about miracles. This is something, he wrote an article in Forbes magazine called Snake Oil and Holy Water. I mean, you have to say about Richard Dawkins, he writes extremely well, you know, has great fluency with words. This is what he says. The resurrection, even the Old Testament miracles, are all freely used for religious propaganda, and they are very effective with an audience of unsophisticates and children. So you know what you are if you believe in miracles. Every one of these miracles amounts to a violation of the normal running of the natural world. And so I just wondered if that's true. Is it true that every miracle really does amount to a violation of the normal running of the natural world? We'll come back to it in a minute. But you see how dismissive he and his colleagues are of those who believe in miracles. So what I want to look at is the last miracle in Exodus story, the crossing of the River Jordan. In many ways, it's a climax. And just to say, if we read this in an academic sense, let's have an academic approach to this miracle. can we actually extract some useful information, even more useful information from it? The miracle is described very clearly and succinctly in two verses in Joshua. If you have your Bibles open, it's Joshua 3:15 and 16. Now the Jordan is in flood all during harvest, yet as soon as the priests who carried the ark reached the Jordan and their feet touched the water's edge, the water from upstream stopped flowing. It piled up in a heap a great distance away at a town called Adam. Adam is again in the vicinity of Zarephath. While the water flowing down to the sea of the Araba, the Dead Sea, was completely cut off, so the people crossed over opposite Jericho. So this is this remarkable scene. The River Jordan is not just flowing normally, it is in flood. The Israelites are on one side, and they want to go on the other side, and they can see the promised land of Canaan on the other side, but they can't get to it because the Jordan's in flood. They've waited about 40 years. They can see this promised land, but the situation looks as hopeless as it looked, you know, for the other 39 or so years. But suddenly, the water stops. It's as if someone upstream has had some great tap, and they turned off the tap, and the water just stopped. And the Israelites just cross over in triumph. So, many of us here will believe that story, but of course, if you went out into Derby, for example, and read it in the streets, people will say, what a great children's story, you know, a great fairy tale. Of course, it can't be true. It must have been invented, you know, someone's just invented this story. And what's also factual is that most biblical scholars believe this story to be a legend. They believe it's a sort of unbelievable story. So, I was reading this story one day, and something struck me about this story, which I'd never read, never struck me before. There's something very odd about the story. So let me ask you these verses. What's very odd about these verses? I will tell you what's very odd about these verses. This is what's very odd about the verses. It says, as soon as the priests who carried the ark reached the Jordan, their feet touched the water's edge, the water from upstream stopped flowing. It piled up in a heap a great distance away. So the writer's saying the miracle didn't happen where the Israelites were, it happened somewhere else. Now, if you're going to make a story up, you know, if you just wouldn't say that. And the writer not only says it's happened somewhere else, he emphasizes, he says it happened at a town called Adam. And then, in case you don't know where it is, he said in the vicinity of Zarephath. So he's just emphasizing this miracle happened somewhere else, he was pointing out to where it was, a great distance away. And the stopping the water a great distance away enabled them to cross where they were. The miracle itself happened somewhere else. So that struck me as very curious. And of course, if you're a scientist, but if you're not a scientist, if you're an academic, you immediately say, you read this, you say, what stopped the water flowing at this place called Adam a great distance away? And is it possible to find out 3,000 years later? And what you find throughout the Exodus story is the attention the writer gives to the details of the geography. So he's trying to point the readers, and I think the initial readers would have been pointed easily to where this happened, but of course it's not so easy for us today. So he says they didn't just cross the Jordan, he said they crossed the Jordan opposite Jericho. He points out where the water was stopped, Adam in the vicinity of Zarephath, and then he says all these places are upstream from the Dead Sea, so which is correct, of course. So he's trying to root this whole story, not only in history, but also in geography as well. The problem we face today is that most place names have disappeared or changed. Not all of them. Jericho hasn't changed. Jericho is Jericho, you know, thousands of years today. Jericho today. But most place names have changed or they've disappeared. And that change, of course, continues. So, you know, what we call Mumbai today was called Bombay a number of years ago. I was interested when I visited Mumbai last year. A lot of the Indians still call it Bombay, which surprised me, so there is this Bombay. Anyway, but the name is Mumbai. But you notice there's a certain similarity between Bombay and Mumbai. And this is the same when names change in the Bible. So modern names can be related to ancient names, just as Mumbai and Bombay are related. The relationship which occurs is usually in the consonant. So ancient Hebrew was a consonantal language. It had no vowels. When you spoke it, you had to put vowel sounds in when you spoke it. The written language was just consonants. And when, I mean, it's a bit like modern text messages, right? So, you know, you have a text message, and in a text message, you put TXT, text, but in your mind, you read it as text, not tixt or toxt or text, right? Because you just know the vowel to put in. And so it was the same with them, so they had a, just the vowels, and Adam would have been the equivalent of D and M. So those are the consonants. And when more modern Arabic names replace more ancient Hebrew names, then what happens is that there's usually an Arabic ending added. And so this is what happens with a number of Palestine names, so you can then trace back. So you then look at a map of Jordan and say, is there a town or, you know, a town or city on the Jordan with the consonants DM? And there it is. There's a place called Damia. And it's on the River Jordan, and it's 70 miles of Jericho. And scholars are agreed that modern Damia is ancient Adam, right? And there's just the DM, there's the consonants of reserve. And so, you probably can't see, so I didn't give you a PowerPoint, but if you can see this, right, this is a simplified drawing. So here's the Mediterranean over here, and this is the Dead Sea, that's the Dead Sea down there. This is the Sea of Galilee, that's the Jordan. This is Jericho, just there, and this is Adam, just 50 miles north. So that's where the water stopped at Adam. Now, here's the science bit. This is where science can be useful when you read the Bible. So July the 11th, 1927, there was an earthquake which shook Jericho, buildings collapsed, you may be interested, the walls fell down. This was detected throughout the world. It was 6.5 on the Richter scale. By comparison, the earthquake in New Zealand in Christchurch on February the 22nd in 2011 killed over 200 people, 6.3 on the Richter scale. This was 6.5, very, very similar. And what happened was that, why do we have this earthquake? The earthquake was because of slippage along what's called the Jericho Fault. So if you think of the River Jericho running down north to south, there's one tectonic plate on one side, one tectonic plate on the other side, and they slip. And this is why there's so many earthquakes recorded in the Bible, because it's an earthquake zone. This particular part of the slippage is known as the Jericho Fault. And it, in fact, is part of the Great Rift Valley. It starts off in Lebanon, it comes down, it goes down the River Jordan, it goes down the Red Sea, and then curls into Ethiopia. It's all part of this, you know, tectonic plate, one on one side and on the other side. So what happened at Adam in this 1927 earthquake? So I wrote to a professor at Stanford University who studied this, and I'll read his letter that he wrote, and he said, during the 1927 earthquake, several ground cracks appeared, together with an outpouring of groundwater. This soil liquefaction phenomenon has been well observed in earthquakes elsewhere. During the earthquake, mudslides occurred along the Jordan near Damia, about 30 kilometres, that's 18 miles, north of Jericho. These temporarily stopped the river's flow. And I have a photograph here, which I hold up. This was, it shows you what happened. This was in 1957, where there was also an earthquake and a mudslide, which didn't quite stop the river's flow, but you'll get the picture. Right? So there's the River Jordan, and there's the mudslide. You can see the water just flows around it. So this is 1957, not quite enough to stop the river's flow, but a larger mudslide would stop the river's flow. So that's what happened in 1927, very well documented. Has it happened before? Yes, it has. This is what Professor Amos Nur said, who's the Stanford geologist. He said, Adam is now Damia, so he repeats this. The site of the 1927 mudslides, which cut off the flow of the Jordan, such cutoffs lasting typically 1 to 2 days. That's the time it takes. So if you have a mudslide, the river's blocked, water comes behind, either has to come over the top of the mudslide or go around it, and that takes typically 1 to 2 days. Have also been recorded in 1906, 1834, 1546, 1534, 1267, and 1160. And then the records stop. Of course, you then go back to Joshua and find another example. This stop in the Jordan is so typical of earthquakes in this region that little doubt can be left of the reality of such events in Joshua's time. So I would say that this is the explanation of that miracle. Because, why do I say this? Because the Bible writer really points out where this miracle, where the water stopped at Adam, and in more modern times, this has happened repeatedly at the same place with an earthquake-induced mudslide. And we know that ancient Adam is modern Dania. So we now have to ask ourselves, though, what do we mean by calling this a miracle? Because in the Old Testament, it's quite clear the Israelites regarded this as a major miracle of God. So let's start by thinking how the ancient Israelites would have thought. If you think about Egypt and their God, the ancient Egypt had many gods. They had a god controlling the rain, a god controlling the rising of the sun, a god controlling the setting of the sun, and so on. Ancient Israel had one god who controlled all the forces of nature. If you like, the Israelites' god just replaced all the Egyptians' gods and was much greater. So, and who controlled everything? So, to the Israelites' minds, if an earthquake had caused the Jordan to stop, they would have said, this is the hand of God, just as much as if God had, as it were, sent an angel to hold the waters back. Why was it a miracle? Because the time is just amazing. That they've been wandering in the desert for 40 years, they've just come to the Jordan, and then the water stops. So the timing, absolutely remarkable. Does the Bible say it's an earthquake? Well, not there, but this is a sort of hint. This is Psalm 114. When Israel came out of Egypt, the sea looked and fled. The Jordan turned back, right? It's talking about Jordan. The mountains leapt like rams, the hills like lambs, tremble, O earth, at the presence of the Lord. Now, okay, when you probably read this, you think tremble, O earth, is probably meant to be taken figuratively. I'm going to say it's probably meant to be taken literally, right? So I think this is a reference to earthquake. When the Bible talks about mountains leaping, that is another way where it's talking about earthquakes and mountains actually moving. So I think that's a hint that this was an earthquake. What about other miracles? Well, this is the crossing of the Red Sea. Crossing the Red Sea, the Bible describes explicitly as a natural mechanism. So Exodus 14:21, then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and all that night the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind and turned it into dry land. Right? No angel sent down, a natural mechanism, a strong east wind, which turned the water into dry land. It's a no mechanism, so it's called wind set down, where if a strong wind blows for a long time, you just force the water back. And you can force the water back by hundreds of yards in a river, for example. So, and again, a miracle of timing, that just when the Israelites were trapped at the Red Sea, the strong wind came into them all night. So a miracle of timing. This is a section from Psalm 77, where the psalmist talks about miracles explicitly. And I think it's a remarkable section, so let's just read this to you. I don't have the verses, so it's quite a long psalm. This is part of your finding. The psalmist says, you are the God who performs miracles. So, this introduction is going to talk about miracles. You display your power among the peoples. Your thunder was heard in the whirlwind. Your thunder was heard in the whirlwind. So your thunder, not just thunder. Your lightning lit up the world. The earth trembled and quaked. Your path led through the sea. So here again, we've got the earth trembling, quaking, the path leading through the sea. Your way through the mighty waters, though your footprints were not seen. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. So he ends by talking about Moses and Aaron. He starts by talking about miracles. The bit in between is about miracles during the Exodus. And he says, your path led through the sea. And he's talking about these natural events, thunder, lightning, earthquakes. And these are being used by God to perform miracles. And the phrase I most like here, which I think is just so remarkable, is, though your footprints were not seen. Right, so the psalmist is saying, God's performed these amazing miracles, he doesn't shout out about it. He doesn't leave a visiting card saying God was here. His footprints were not seen. Why? Because he's working in with and through the nature he created to cause these miracles. And the miracles are in the time. Well, let's just go back and picture the scene again. I don't know if any of you have been to Israel and seen the River Jordan. okay, well, I have something murder. And I know when I saw it, I mean, it's a pretty pathetic river, and I thought, why didn't they swim across? And the problem is that since 1940, both Israel and Jordan have used a large quantity of irrigation, so that's why it's a pathetic river now. We're told the river was in flood because harvest time. What happens is that the Israelites crossed in the spring. It was the 10th day of the first month, for them, the first month being Nisan, which corresponds to March, April, which is in the spring. That's when the snow melts on Mount Hermon, and that's when the Jordan does indeed flood. And I've got a picture here of the River Jordan, which was taken in the 19th century, quite a rare picture. This is the River Jordan in flood. You might be able to see it here, right? So it's a huge barrier to cross. And there was an expedition also in the 19th century, which a British expedition to Jordan in the 19th century, which says the Jordan in flood was half a mile wide. Right? So this was a huge barrier to cross. And that's the water which stopped and the river that the Israelites crossed. I'll finish in a few minutes and I'll continue my next talk a bit. So, can we learn anything from this? Well, I think we can. I think if what we're saying is correct, this interpretation, then what we're saying is with some miracles, God is working in with and through nature, and his footprints are not seen. We know it's a miracle because of the timing. And then, this is really tentative, but this is where I think maybe we can learn something. How did God achieve the timing? We can ask that question, very tentative. This earthquake or natural event. And I think it is plausible that Joshua was an active agent in this miracle. Right? If God's going to work in through him with nature, then he needs to get the Israelites there when this earthquake-induced mudslide occurs. So it seems to me that here the Israelites going through the desert, and then God says to Joshua, start a bit, speed up a bit. This timing has to be achieved. I think Joshua, maybe his mind was close to the mind of God. So he was an agent in this process and sped up and slowed down when prompted. I'd like to suggest that the same may happen today. I think that miracles of timing happen a lot today where God works with and through nature. If we're attuned to the mind of God, then God can use us in these sorts of miracles. I mean, we all know, looking back, these chance events where you happen to be walking down a street and someone you haven't seen for years, other direction, you have a conversation which may have changed his life or your life. And these times are really important. And maybe God is saying to, you know, the Christian, consciously or subconsciously, you know, why don't you go down the street or just speed up a bit as you walk down here? So that may be how God actually achieves his miracles, in some of his miracles. This is a quotation I like quite much. It's a book written by someone called Hoikus, called Religion and the Rise of Modern Science. And he says, the scientist, even when he is a believer, is bound to try as far as possible to reduce miracles to regularities. The believer, even when he is a scientist, discovers miracles in the most familiar things. So I'll just read that again. So he said, the scientist, even when he is a believer, is bound to try as far as possible to reduce miracles to regularities. Why? Because you don't leave your science behind when you read the Bible. So you try to say, you know, can God be working in with and through nature in this miracle? And I think with a number of miracles, the answer is yes. With a number, the answer is no. And I'll say in my talk tomorrow that things like the resurrection are really special things where God is acting differently. And I'll just mention that tomorrow. I was going to mention it today, but I don't have time. But let me finish by saying the believer, even when he's a scientist, because scientists get a bit hard-nosed sometimes, discovers miracles in the most familiar things. So what Hoikus is saying is, look, don't lose your sense of wonder. Just look at really familiar things and realize the wonder in these really familiar things. Okay, then I'll continue tomorrow and we'll talk just about the resurrection and how scientists can believe in the resurrection. Something where God acts very specially and in some other miracles. Okay, thank you very much.